Found some cryptic diversity within Suga, which was surprising. Hemlock from Oolong Island, Korea, which is a small volcanic island off the coast of Korea. These hemlocks have always been considered to be Suga seiboldii.
DNA fingerprinting technique, it generates various different bands of a different length. It is reproducible. There is a high resolution, and generally it is time efficient. It has been used to determine population structure in organisms such as the winter pine processionary moth. They did find strong geographic structure in this moth. This moth is based in two different species, but they did actually find some genetic differences between these two species, and within this one, they actually did find a lot of population structure between the different sites that they actually did collect the beetles. It has also been used to look at population structure in an invasive species, the gypsy moth. They did find local population structure, as you can see with the groupings, and they did have one sample from the U.S. This is all in Europe. From Pennsylvania, and that is grouping with the German samples. So for emerald ash borer, this is the tree that we get with even a subset of my data. This is not all of the information, and sadly you can't even read this. But concentrate on the colors. So everything that does not have a color is from North America, and China is depicted in blue, Korea is depicted in orange, and Japan is depicted in blue. Did I say that right? Green, orange, blue. And what's happening is most of the North American populations are grouping with individuals from China, so the green ones. Korea pretty much groups with individuals from China as well, so more than likely there's no Korean specimen that is grouping with Michigan samples or North American samples, because I have Ohio and Illinois in here as well. So there's no Korean specimen that is actually grouping with a North American specimen. So the likelihood of Korea being the source population of the North American introduction is really low. Now, given the fact that this tree is one big jumbly mess and it doesn't actually give us a specific answer of the origin of EAB, we're actually using another technique with microsatellites that we're working on right now. Microsatellites are simple sequence tandem repeats, basically a set of DNA that just repeats over and over again. Because it repeats over and over again, slippage is very high, so mutation rates are also very high. It's polymorphic, and it is a codominant marker, so we are able to look for heterozygosity. It has been used in the western corn rootworm, where they actually were able to identify that invasive species was from North America into Europe, and they did find three separate introductions from North America. And generally, there was low genetic diversity in Europe, so they believe that that was from single pop or single introductions that stayed within themselves, and then it spread from the introduction sites. It also was used in boll weevils. If you look at this map over here, they actually were doing eradication sites from boll weevils, and they did find a new site or a new sample that was found in this region, and they were trying to figure out where it came from. What they believe, given this haplotype network, it actually was grouping Rosales. So they believe that the individuals in Tahulo, I probably mispronounced that, came from Rosales, but there was also some individuals that split off on their own, so it may have been a population that was there but undetected for quite some time. So for emerald ash borer, we have 96 clones that have been prepared. 62 of those clones were used for primer development. 32 of those have been tested and are successful for amplification, and we're actually currently testing those for polymorphism within a group of our populations. So overall for EAB, the mitochondrial sequence basically is leading us to conclude that more than likely the North American population of EAB came from China, and one specific part in China is what I'm suspecting. And the genetic diversity in Korea is not found in North America, so the likelihood of EAB coming from Korea is really low. The AFLP markers are also leading us to believe that it came from a site in China, but that more samples are needed to actually use population assignment tests to make sure that we can confidently decide that. And the microsatellite markers are hoping, we're hoping that they will actually increase our knowledge of where this insect came from. Some challenges to do this type of work with an invasive species is it's very difficult to obtain samples from where you're not at. So trying to go to Asia and or find collaborators that are willing to collect insects for you to get a high enough sample size is really hard. In some of these locations, they just won't let you collect. I did have that issue in some of my populations in Korea and Japan when I went over there. And also, you do need to develop the primers to be able to do these. So for specific individual species, you have to develop these techniques and then be able to try to run it through. So that is time consuming. And because it's time consuming and the cost of genetic work, the cost can be high, and wonderfully it is actually going lower the more people do it. The benefits, I believe, outweigh the cost though. We are able to attempt to identify geographic origin of EAB. We have a pretty good idea of where it came from. With further data, we can confidently say that. We can facilitate the reconstruction of the invasion history, and we may be able to detect important changes within the biology. Since this beetle is not used to dealing with North American Fraxinus, there may be some changes within the beetle that would help us be able to control it. We also can use the microsatellite techniques possibly to determine how many introductions came in, the main method of spread, because we are hunter-gatherer organisms. We pretty much like to bring our firewood everywhere we go. So that is a big problem to try to figure out if humans are the main spread of emerald ash borer or if it actually is moving along itself. And the number of individuals the number of females that can start an outlier population would also be interesting to find out and give implications on control within that population. So to end, I would like to thank all these incredible people for helping me do this work. My sample would not have happened. All the insects that I have were pretty much collected by all these absolutely wonderful people, and my project co-authors and my major professor, and of course my funding sources, which this work made possible. Thank you. Any questions? Yeah.
Do you have any idea the sort of sample sizes that you would like to get? Satellite work and what's realistic?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. There has been studies on how many individuals you need to be able to confidently figure this out. We would prefer 20 individuals to be able to run the statistics on it, which would give us a high confidence value. 10 individuals still gives us information, and hopefully we can at least do that. I have enough individuals per each population to run it. It just makes sure that if we can financially do it. Yeah.
A follow-up question is, do you have any idea of population structure from your sites? Like over how big an area can you collect individuals and be confident that they're part of the same population?
Right, that's an excellent question. There's also other statistical tests that we can use to see what is the genetic population structure, and I'm hoping to actually run all my data through to be able for the data to tell me what the population structure is, not me saying these populations are not breeding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but it's just if you have 20 samples from a certain area and then you later decide that there are five different populations, then suddenly you have five populations of four individuals rather than one population with one.
Right. I have many, many more populations, especially in Michigan, than I will need. So when I choose my populations, I'm actually choosing them so they're geographically separate from each other, not just very close. I mean, they're very separate from each other, so the insect itself could not move by itself from one population to another. But I'm also running the populations through that statistical test to be able to figure out if they're actually genetically different from each other. Oh, the native populations. Oh, I can do that with them too. Yeah.
When you approach making the lambda loci for the microsatellite, did you start off with something like ISSR primers to get fragments and look at them, or how did you do that?
For the microsatellites, I actually sent off DNA to the Surreal Lab. And they developed the clones for me, and they sequenced everything. They sent me files of the sequenced clones, and I designed the primers from the clones that they gave me.
What lab was that?
The Surreal Lab, Servo Lab.
Savannah River Ecology Lab, Georgia?
Yes. They're fantastic, and it actually saved a lot of time, and it was cost effective to send it to Travis Glenn. Any other questions? Thank you.
I'm going to talk about the avocado thrips. It's a serious pest of avocados here in California, and how we've used molecular markers to resolve some of the taxonomic confusion surrounding this pest and also determine the origin of the invasive California population. Now, the avocado industry in California is worth about $300 million a year, and until relatively recently it was pretty much pest and disease free. But this changed at the end of the 20th century with the introduction first in 1990 of the Picea mite, and then the avocado thrips, which was first detected attacking avocados in July of 1996 at two distinct points around Port Hueneme in Ventura County and some 100 or so miles further south around Irvine in Orange County. And free from natural enemies in California, this thrip spread very quickly, and by 2003 almost all avocado groves in California were infested with this pest to some degree. It outbreaks in early spring, and feeding by the thrips importantly damages young developing fruit, which results in scarring of the fruit and downgrading of that fruit in the packing house. And long-term estimates for the thrips predict that it costs the California avocado industry somewhere between $4.5 and $8.5 million per year. Industry estimates for 2006 for the single year, which was a particularly good year for the thrips, put that figure at $60 million. So it's a serious economic pest. Now, when it was first detected in California, it was a new species. It was described and given the name Skirtthrips persei. And since then, its home range has been defined as the avocado growing region stretching from central Mexico down through into central Guatemala. Within this region, it occurs in isolated patches only on avocados growing at altitudes greater than 1500 meters. Now the question is, how did it jump from there to here? Well, we know that it's monophagous, and studies at UC Riverside have also shown that it has a fundamental requirement for living avocado leaves in order to feed and reproduce. Importantly, it cannot survive on the mature fruit, which is a commodity which is commonly imported both legally and illegally into the state. So it must have come here on avocado plants. Now, the importation of plants into California is rightly, strictly regulated, but there also exists long waiting lists in California for avocado plants with which to start new groves. And so we would believe that this creates a black market or a potential black market for smuggled avocado plants. And therefore we believe that the only way a viable founding population of avocado thrips could have established in California is from infested plant material or plants smuggled in from somewhere in its native range. Now, in case you're wondering why we want to, its native range looks fairly small in the first place, so in case you're wondering why we want to further resolve its origin, well, it's important for two particular reasons, and I'm sure many more as well. Firstly, as I mentioned previously, in California there's no effective natural enemies for this pest, that's why it does so well. And so identifying the origin of the pest as part of an integrated pest management program will help us focus our search for natural predators, parasitoids of this species. And secondly, it may also put us in a better position to intercept future imports, not only of this pest, but of other pests as well. The arrival in California of Scirtothrips persei was preceded, as I mentioned previously, by the Persea mite in 1990, an equally injurious pest. And prior to that, a slightly less injurious pest, the red-banded whitefly, in 1982. Now, both of these species bear remarkable similarities to the avocado thrips. Like the thrips, they both have a fundamental requirement for avocado leaves in which to feed and reproduce. And like the thrips, they've both subsequently been found to be native to Mexico. And so by identifying the origin of the avocado thrips, we may actually be also uncovering a key pathway of invasion for pests of avocado into California. Okay, at the outset of this research, we had one further problem that we needed to tackle, and that was to answer the question as to whether we were calling Scirtothrips persei was in fact a single species or some kind of species complex. And this confusion was brought about largely by a controversial review of the genus in Mexico, which listed 7 species from avocado, and 5 of these were newly described. These descriptions were based on characters which are known to be highly variable within this group, within recognized species within this group, and also made from poorly prepared specimens. So the first thing we wanted to tackle really was we wanted to answer the question, are we working with a single species? How do we go about this? Well, in the first spring following its detection in California, there was a coordinated collecting effort in Ventura and Orange County groves to collect specimens of avocado thrips, and this material was in storage at UCR. We supplemented this material with an extensive collection of specimens throughout discrete geographical areas through the native range of the pest, collected during 2002 to 2004, and also a further collection of material from groves throughout California, again in 2004. And we took these specimens and we extracted some DNA, and we use a particular extraction technique which preserves the specimen, which can then be retrieved from your extraction, cleared and slide mounted. So every specimen in this study for which we have molecular data, we also have the morphological data should we wish to go back to it. So the first thing we looked at, in an attempt to clear up some of the taxonomic confusion surrounding the pest and also perhaps identify some larger scale population differentiation, were some relatively conserved markers. In particular, we looked at the ITS1, ITS2 and 28SD2 regions of nuclear ribosomal RNA and also the CO1 region of mitochondrial DNA. And the nuclear ribosomal sequences suggested that what we were collecting was indeed a single species. 28SD2 sequences were identical for every specimen we sequenced, right throughout California and its native range. And while showing a small amount of variation, which is typical of the ITS regions, ITS1 and ITS2 were also very similar. And the two gel pictures here, on the left, we have, this is the ITS1 product and the ITS2 product, and you can see that within right across the range of the pest, there's no variation in the size of these products. And this varies, to compare that with the same regions in other species of skirter thrips, you can see that there are clear differences there. We've actually developed these interspecific differences as part of a molecular key to several species of several pest species of skirter thrips. Okay, so the nuclear ribosomal sequences suggested that we were dealing with a single species. In contrast, our mitochondrial DNA actually revealed the existence of three distinct and highly divergent haplotype groups. What we have here is a haplotype network constructed from approximately 660 base pairs of the CO1 gene of 47 specimens. Each bubble represents a particular haplotype. The size of the bubble is indicative of how many individuals shared that particular haplotype, and the lines connecting the bubbles, or at least the numbers by the lines, show the differences in terms of the number of nucleotide substitutions between the haplotypes. And in group one, this group at the top, we found all our specimens from California fell into this group, plus all the specimens from populations in the center of the native range of this pest. And no two haplotypes in this group vary from each other by more than three base pairs. In contrast, group two, which contained only specimens from the northern reaches of the native range, and group three, which contained only specimens from the southern reaches of the native range, differed from group one by more than 50 base pairs, and from each other by more than 30 base pairs. That's about 8% sequence divergence. Now, whether this is enough to call them different species, we simply don't know, and I think that can only really be answered by someone probably in Mexico undertaking mating compatibility trials between these three haplotypes. But importantly for this project, we were able to rule out material from these two regions as potential sources of the Californian population, leaving only four potential source populations as the source of the California population, all in Mexico, those at Puebla, Coatepec Arenas, Chalapa de Diez, and Huapam. Now, within this region, there still remains a degree of population isolation, and so we look for further population differentiation using some highly polymorphic markers, microsatellites. And one of the problems with working with microsatellites is you don't typically know what you're going to get until you look for them. And unfortunately, we were only able to look at four microsatellites. It appears that some species are just poorer in at least good polymorphic loci than others, and I guess we got unlucky. But we were able to consider these four loci, allele frequencies in these four loci, in seven population samples, three from California, our own collection in 2004, and the original collections in Ventura County and Orange County in 1997, and then the four native populations from Mexico, Chalapa de Dios, Coatepec Arenas, Huapam, and Puebla. I apologize for this slide and the next three. It's quite difficult to put this into any other format. So we had four loci. Thankfully, there was no evidence for linkage between these loci, so we were able to assume they were independent. And of the two locus population combinations, only two showed significant deviation from Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. But with that in mind, our subsequent analyses do not assume Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. Okay, so here we have two commonly used measures of population differentiation. Pairwise estimates of FST above the diagonal and Nye's unbiased genetic distances below the diagonal. Essentially, these yield values between 0 and 1, with 0 being no differentiation, 1 being complete differentiation. The first thing to take from this slide is the similarity of our California samples. In particular, the similarity between the original samples from Orange County and Ventura County in 1997. That's this value here. This is not significantly different from zero, and essentially we can apply from that that the invading populations in those two, at the two focal points of the invasion, originated from a single invasion event. They came from the same place, most likely at the same time. Furthermore, the similarity between the original 97 collections and our own 04 collection, again, this value is not significantly different from zero, and this is only marginally non-significant. Again, this implies that no further importations of this pest have taken place between 97 and 04, or if they have, they certainly haven't established. And the second thing to take from this table is the similarity, or the relative similarity, between our California samples and those from the native population in Coatepec Arenas in Mexico. To put it simply, our California samples are more similar to the Coatepec Arenas sample than they are to the other four, to any of the other three native populations. And this was also reflected in the results of an assignment test. This analysis looks at multi-locus genotypes in the invading population, and based on allele, on microsatellite allele frequencies in each of the native populations, it calculates the probability that each invading genotype could have come from each of the native populations. And in an ideal world where we had 20 or so microsatellites, we would hopefully be able to unambiguously assign each invading genotype to a single source population. But with four microsatellite loci, we were unable to do this. And so what we have here, we assigned individuals to the native population which had the highest probability score. And we have actual numbers of individuals that are assigned to each native population from Ventura and Orange counties, and then the combined. And in brackets following these whole numbers, we have the mean probability that any given invading genotype would be assigned to each of the native populations. And we found that invading genotypes were significantly more likely to be assigned to Coatepec Arenas than any of the other three native populations. So this, it appears that the California population of Skirtifrips persei most likely arrived from Coatepec Arenas in Mexico. Now this is quite interesting because lo and behold, Coatepec Arenas is actually the site of a large avocado breeding and germplasm station. And as such, it's more likely to attract foreign visitors, perhaps, than the other three native areas that were sampled, which are, relatively speaking, more and more.